Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. Excellent, excellent. Good afternoon, beloved members of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street. Are you here? Are you there on camera? I'm still Kate Walker. On a roll. I use the she, her pronouns. I am pale-skinned 60-year-old woman with light brown hair and a pixie cut. I wear glasses, and I am in my favorite red sleeveless dress. I have the honor of serving as your scribe. To all of you here in person and those in scattered lands near and far, as well as those watching in the future, I hereby convene and welcome you to the 203rd Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, being held here in my home city of Pittsburgh. I invite you to focus on our chalice lighting. We are gathered in body and spirit with joys and grief, all of which are too much to bear alone, and none of which can be fully given description. We seek connection, love renewed, friendship, collegiality, and the reminder that our faith in each other remains strong and resilient. May the light of this chalice burn bright in our hearts, offering affirmation for our joys and ease for our pain. May it remind us we are connected to one another in the past, in the present, and the future, in an unbroken line of prophetic voices found in this conference. In my role as scribe, I manage the archives, convene the executive committee of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, and this gorgeous and magnificent body made of you. The members, I also manage, to the best of my ability, the members of the Unitarian Universalist Ministers Executive Committee. And on behalf of them, I welcome you all here, as well as our esteemed guests. The Executive Committee is charged with choosing the essayist for this conference. I, in turn, have the honor of extending that invitation. It truly is one of my favorite phone calls of the year. This past year, the members of the Executive Committee were Lynn Gardner, Jose Ballester, and Aisha Ansano. And of course, Aisha's here. And it is with deep sadness, of course, that I call out Jose's name into this beloved body. And his recent death being a reminder of Jose's dedication to the UUMA. Having served in many roles over his years, for his capacity for love, laughter, and singing, and he will be missed by all of us. For my annual scribe remarks, I did a deep dive into the essays since 1961. What was I looking for, you may ask? I'm so glad you asked. I was looking to see if the essayist had been talking about the Unitarian Universalist principles and purposes. If they had been, what did they say? This line of inquiry seemed timely, since we Unitarian Universalists seem to be in quite a fuss about changing them. So what has our wise colleagues have to say and guide us? From 1961 to 1987, there are a few mentions of the principles and the essays, but not with a capital P in principles and purposes, just the generic brand. Things shifted in the mid-1980s, which is when our religious educators started centering the principles and purposes in the curriculum, in part because so many of us realized our children didn't know they were Unitarian Universalists. They all could tell you all about the world's religions, and they could meditate. But they had no idea about their own faith identity. So the principles and purposes then became part of generations of emerging young Unitarian Universalists. But even after gaining more attention, no essayist focused on the principles and purposes as a primary target or a resource. For those who did mention them, there is a telling message. In 1987, Eugene Pickett praised the recent changes in the curriculum when he said, quote, "In addition to the accomplishments I just mentioned, and I want to reemphasize the importance of restating our principles and purposes, we established a new direction for our religious education program." Great. Sounds good. Then in 2009, Paul Raiser began the campaign and how they have failed us. Quote, "The Unitarian Universalist culture for our youth and young adults of color experience may not be relevant to their life experiences, even though many of them have been UUs from birth. Feelings of being an outsider are prevalent. The vision of community promised by our seven principles often fails them." Although he did qualify that, quote, "our commitment to creating a genuinely multiracial, multicultural Unitarian Universalism has deep roots, and that those roots include our principles and purposes. Then in 2012, Fred Muir continued with the thread of concern as he called us to look at the shadow side of the principles when he wrote, "When used as an expression of individualism, rather than expression of joy and celebration of individuality, the principles come dangerously close to sounding like an ideology or creed turned theology and spirituality." Fred then reminded us of the words of Robert Bella, who strongly called out UUs as engaging in a serious overconsumption of individualism as held out in our principles. Sean Dennison wisely pointed out in 2015 that the Unitarian Universalist principles and purposes don't mention forgiveness. And finally, in 2019, Leslie Takahashi called us to caution with our first principle, which she said, "Debates among us sometimes misinterpret our principle as being not about ultimate worth, but about absolute rights to comfort for some." So overall, our essays have said very little about our principles and purposes, but when they have spoken, it was with concern. One interpretation of my very short review is that while we put the principles in the center of our faith for our children's identity, we then found those principles failed them. Or perhaps this includes our now grown children, failed to live up to those principles. And yet the principles are not rotten at the core. They are good to go. I offer this really as consideration for the larger conversation that is about to take off, well, continue, one would say, from digital to live format. As I wrap up my scribe remarks, after 9 years, I need to announce and want to announce that this is my last year as your Berry Street Conference Scribe. 9 years is enough. When I jumped at the chance of what I still think is the dream job, I also knew it needed a time limit. I end my term with a bounty of gratitude for your constant love and support. I have truly loved my role as a deep gratitude for this important institution, and I remind you that the delicate and important balance of this conference in relationship to the UUMA, which I describe as intentionally partially inside and outside of the two institutions, the conference is a bond of union, and it's a moment to reflect on the health of that bond. In my view, our collegial bond began in 1820. at the first ministerial conference in Berry Street, under the guiding light of William Ellery Channing, the very first scribe and essayist. Thank you, William Ellery Channing. And if you believe that serving as a scribe is your dream job, there is an application on the UUMA website. The position is chosen by the executive committee and then appointed by the UUMA board. I highly recommend your serious consideration. We turn now to our prayer, offered by outgoing member of the executive committee, Lynn Gardner. It will be followed by the moderator, who will introduce our speaker, and we will have two respondents, and then I will wrap up today's conference with gratitude and announcements. Lynn?
Dear colleagues, religious professionals, Unitarian Universalists, family and friends, will you join me in a time of prayer, time of centering and opening? Receiving the gift of a breath, we exhale to arrive more fully in this moment. Spirit of life and love, that which moves within us and among us. Dear God, we gather today with much on our hearts. We give thanks for the life and ministry of Reverend Jose Ballester, who died peacefully on June 7th. After years of serving in congregations as a leader of LUNA, the Latinx UU Networking Association, and as a valued and imperfect colleague and human. May his beloved wife, Susan, and their extended family and all those grieving be held in care. And may our friend and colleague rest in power. Nuestro amigo y colega que descansa en poder. And Holy One, we are so grateful for the tenacious and faithful courage of Reverend Cecilia Kingman, and all that she has done to prepare for this time together. We give thanks for the respondents and their thoughtful and heartful reflections. May they each be buoyed by your power and grace. May those who will be listening or reading prepare our hearts and mind as well for the good word we have the opportunity to receive. May wisdom move among us all as we consider these difficult ideas. May we allow ourselves to be changed by new understandings and new commitments. And together we say, Amen.
As per our custom, we now need a moderator to introduce the speaker, and we once again enter into an arcane and odd ritual, which is truly beyond the understanding of this scribe. I now invite a nomination from the floor for our moderator.
Sophia Betancourt.
Excellent choice. I hear the name Sophia Betancourt. And hearing no further nominations, I hereby close the nominations and by vote of acclamation invite Sophia Betancourt to the podium to introduce our speaker. Oh, arcane rituals, what we're known for, right? Beloveds, What a blessing to gather once again with all of you for this esteemed part of our cultural, theological, and intellectual inheritance. We have the great gift this year of receiving an essay from one who has dedicated her life to the study of a topic that is not only central to her ministerial and prophetic calling, but also urgent, immediate, and impactful on our own. It is my privilege this afternoon to tell you a bit about my friend and colleague, the Reverend Cecilia Kingman, who I have known since 1998, when I first set foot in Star King School for the Ministry as a prospective student. Cecilia may not remember me sitting in a class that she was taking, but I remember finding a future colleague whose depth, commitment, and analysis felt similar to my own. And that experience helped me to imagine finding my place at Star King, when at that time my entire UU timeline leading up to that amounted to time with my grandfather in our Barnstable, Massachusetts congregation, and time in my own home church of Ithaca, New York. So on those days when you've really had it with me, blame Cecilia. I'm kidding. I want to tell you about a religious leader who challenged us to take the prophetic teachings of Oscar Romero seriously all those years ago. This parent and caregiver who has raised 5 children, 3 of whom are with us today, as is her sister. Cecilia is a minister, scholar, educator, and activist. She was raised Baptist and first heard a call to ministry at the very early age of 9. I think it will not surprise us this week that she was told she could not be a minister because of her gender. Let us pause for a moment in respect for our sister colleagues, whose very human counterparts worked to further silence their leadership this week in the Southern Baptist Convention. Cecilia still identifies as a Christian, with liberation theology as the grounding center of her life of faith. She graduated from Star King School for the Ministry in 2003 with me, and was ordained into our Unitarian Universalist ministry in 2008. And since then, she has served congregations in Oregon, California, and Washington State, most recently as Minister for Faith and Justice in Edmonds, Washington. Now, I have been instructed in writing that I must tell you that she has been serving as my campaign manager this year. And truly, my journey would not have been the same without her profound vision and steadfast leadership. Cecilia is currently pursuing a Doctor of Ministry degree at Pacific School of Religion, where her research focuses on the interaction of faith communities with totalitarian and fascist regimes. As I indicated at the beginning, she has been studying authoritarianism for most of her life. Some of the context for that study includes over 10 years in leadership of Project Harvest Hope, a joint project of Transylvanian Unitarians and North American UUs. Cecilia has made more than 16 trips to Transylvania in the last 2 decades and lived there with her children for a full semester during her time of study at Star King. She's a proud educator member of Lareda, and understands religious education as inseparable from everything else that she does as a minister and as a fully human being in this life. As an activist, she is fully and firmly committed to civil disobedience as a moral path. And with that, I invite us to really settle in for this offering. It will ask a lot of us. And that is, in the end, the purpose of our gathering, to learn together, to share great wisdom, and to be changed and ready for the ministry ahead. With immense gratitude, I introduce to you the Reverend Cecilia Kingman.
gosh, there are a bunch of ponies in the house.
Including some up here. There you go. Thank you so much for the honor of giving this address. It is a humbling experience to be asked. There are so many people who would have brought a powerful word to us, and I am honored to have been asked. I think I said, why me? And I am deeply humbled and honored to follow in this long tradition. My subject today is fascism. I think we all know that by now. And this automatically means that I will be talking about systemic harm and trauma, which has unequally targeted us. Some of us have endured the effects more heavily than others, and it matters that we take that seriously. I want to thank my respondents, Elizabeth Stevens and C.B. Beale. You will see that in addition to my being white, my two respondents are also white as well. Between us, we also hold identities that are marginalized in our culture, including class, disability, and gender. But we are all racialized as white, and that matters this afternoon. There's a reason for this choice of mine. In this country, the impacts of fascism and authoritarianism have historically fallen most heavily upon our Indigenous and Black siblings and our other siblings of color. Far too often, we white Unitarian Universalists have asked our siblings of color to come before us and perform suffering for our consumption, and I am unwilling to participate in that kind of harm. Instead, today, rather than ask for more labor, we are going to resource those most historically impacted by systems of oppression. So I have requested an extension of the caucus spaces for our colleagues who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color, as well as the caucus spaces for our trans and disabled colleagues in the back. These spaces will remain open for an additional half hour after this talk. I know it's not much, but we are a union town here, and that's an awesome thing too, so we are abiding by timelines. I recognize that for those among us who exist in the intersections of these categories, this, as always, leaves you with a choice, and I will trust that you will gather as needed. For those of you who are Black, Indigenous, or of color, your caucus can decide if it would be useful for me to come and be with you or not. I will be out there and at the ready. Also, I invite everyone to do what you need to do during this address to care for yourself. Talking about how authoritarian figures control people can be activating for many of us. Those of us who have traditionally been targets of authoritarian violence, survivors of family trauma or systemic violence, and frankly, anyone may find it activating because this is simply an upsetting subject. So, I remind you of what you know. I explicitly invite everyone here to get up and stretch or pace a bit, leave the room, change your seat, get a chaplain, or text your partner or friend, or my favorite, look at photos on my phone, on your phone, that bring you peace. That might help. Obviously, you don't need my permission to take care of yourself, but I want to be clear that this year part of the Berry Street essay is an expectation that people will move their bodies and be free. I want you to experience freedom while I am talking about authoritarianism and fascism. Agreed? I knew immediately when the committee asked me to give this address that fascism would be my subject, as my family and friends, and honestly anybody who's ever talked to me for more than 5 minutes would tell you, this is always my subject. I'm a lot of fun at parties. Since I was a child, though, I have been trying to understand the roots of authoritarianism and other inappropriate uses of power. As a survivor of childhood abuse, I am compelled to understand why people with power cause harm to others and to understand the tactics they use. Before I go on, I want to name the experiences and the teachers and mentors who've given me such a deep understanding of my topic or supported me in my work. First, I want to name my own moment of what liberation theologians call conscientization. I was raised in a moderately conservative Baptist family, as you heard, and I am the descendant of many generations of colonizers and settlers. My moment of awakening to systems of oppression did not arrive until I was 18, when one of my parents was arrested and then convicted of felony embezzlement. My exposure to the carceral system began tearing away the conservative ideologies in which I was raised. Every time I visited my imprisoned parent, I looked straight into the mouth of that beast. And it became quickly clear to me that my privilege as a white girl had cloaked certain realities. Just when the structures that seemed to hold up the world turned out to be monstrosities, I found the teachings of liberation theology. I also found my way through the doors of First Unitarian Church in Portland, Oregon. These two strands, Christian liberation theology and our liberating faith, became and have been the bedrock of my theology for 30 years. While in seminary, I began focusing my studies on the church's response to authoritarianism with the most generous guides and teachers along the way. I attended Star King during the years of Rebecca Parker's presidency, and I was so fortunate to have her as my advisor as well as my professor. I became close friends the very first day with the late Laszlo Kiss, Laci, a Unitarian minister who had grown up under the communist dictatorship in Romania, and his wife Matilda, and that relationship led to more than 20 years of friendship and work with the Unitarians of Romania and Hungary. I worked alongside our colleagues David Keyes and Rob Eller Isaacs, both of whom we lost in the last year. Together, we witnessed firsthand the aftermath of communism and hopes for democracy, then the subsequent betrayals of neoliberalism and capitalism, and then the return of nationalism and authoritarianism to Eastern Europe. I want to honor my colleagues in Romania who continue to teach me, in particular, my dear friends, Gheru David, formerly the deputy bishop of the Hungarian Unitarian Church, and Kopandi Botond and Kovac Sandor, both professors at the Protestant Theological Seminary in Kolozsvár. I am deeply grateful for their willingness to share with me their knowledge and their personal experience of living under authoritarian regimes. And finally, I want to lift up the teachers whom I call beloved, my family. I am, as Sophia said, the parent and step-parent of young people who are queer, non-binary, transgender, Jewish, and South Asian. I also share a home with my sister Jennifer, who is disabled. And these people teach me every day what it means to insist on one's own humanity and to do so with a fierce joy. They educate me, they call me out, they make me laugh. My children have pushed me as an aging Gen Xer to perceive things in new ways. They are part of my ongoing conscientization. And yes, my youngest two are the reason I love My Little Pony and always will, even though they have outgrown our brightly colored friends. Thank you, my loves. But the diversity of my family is not me. As a scholar and minister who is racialized as white, I need to be transparent about my family history, which is overlapping with the history of our faith tradition. I come from many generations of white settlers and colonizers. Three of my four grandparents were descended from some of the earliest English settlers, those who arrived here on the Mayflower. At least two of my grandparents had ancestors who enslaved other human beings here in North America. This is simply a fact, and it must be named. This history of my family was taught to me as part of the glorified lies we are all told about our nation's founding. And these ancestors of mine are also our religious ancestors. It is simply a fact, and it must be named. I have a personal connection. We have a religious connection to the project of violent conquest, genocide, and displacement. My family didn't use those words, but that was the truth behind the simple story. The covering up over generations of these brutalities does not mean that they have no impact. To be white in this country and to have lived here for more than one generation is to be a generational participant in massive historical violence and to have been enrolled in maintaining the mythologies that perpetuate that violence even today. White children are forcefully and sometimes forcibly enrolled in the project of whiteness. White children are required to cut off parts of themselves in order to maintain societal and familial approval. Just as people assigned male or female as children are taught to behave in certain ways, so are white children taught to act in ways that distinguish those who are deemed white from those who are deemed not white. Thus, some children are taught the myth of their own separateness and superiority. When, not if, but when, children fail to comply with those gendered or racialized expectations, they experience, at minimum, a removal of approval and connection. This is deeply traumatic to young children. And so we learn to cut off parts of ourselves to stay connected and to receive the benefits of being within the circle of privilege. To do this, we cut off our compassion, our sense of kinship with other people, and our emotional responses. Cutting off parts of ourselves to survive, which we have all likely done, injures the soul. For those of us who are white, being taught to overlook the atrocities done by our ancestors and the continued oppression and land theft being done by our people, especially when we are told that this oppression and theft is done to secure our own future, this is deeply injurious. This turning away from truth is demanded of children long before a child can be considered complicit. But even when young, most of us do have, deep down, an awareness that something isn't right, that we are being lied to, that we are being enrolled in, and then ultimately choosing to participate in a system of violence. This awareness causes a particular form of moral injury that white people, especially white men, have been passing down generation after generation. And it is absolutely against the rules of whiteness to discuss the psychic wounds of learning to be an oppressor. Friends, this moral injury makes fertile ground for fascism. The belief in one's own special place, combined with the traumatic indoctrination into that belief, the immoral deal one must make to trade parts of oneself for a myth of superiority, this injury creates a psychological and moral framework that makes one vulnerable to fascist ideologies. Now, I want to be clear, white people's moral injury and generational trauma are not comparable to the horrific violence directed at Indigenous and Black people. But white people must dig into our own generational trauma to understand the current situation. White nationalism gets its hooks into white people because of this unacknowledged, unhealed white trauma. Telling the truth and healing that trauma are crucial to the project of resisting fascism. So this afternoon, I want to focus on recognizing and countering fascism without and within our faith. Fascism without seems pretty obvious. We all know that we are in a moment of grave danger. If anyone is left wondering how bad it is, it's very, very bad. It's alarmingly easy, however, for us to grow acclimated and numb unless we pay rigorous attention to the strategies and timelines used by fascists. We are also seeing a rise in fascist thinking within our own faith community. Not necessarily the political ideologies we associate with fascism, but the style of thinking. Please understand that I do not say this lightly. Unitarian Universalism is currently in a moment of major theological transformation and institutional reform. And this transition is causing a backlash within our congregations and among some of our own colleagues. We are moving away from individualism to communitarian values, from white supremacy culture to truly radical liberation, from a concentration of power among historically privileged groups and towards a new form of power sharing. And it is gorgeous. And some are responding to these shifts with anxiety and conflict. Some who are being asked to give up the primacy of their privilege and power are responding with tactics drawn from fascist politics. It's not surprising. The Protestant tradition in North America, the tradition in which we are rooted, has been utterly complicit in the project of fascism and white supremacy. Our faith tradition is rooted in historic hierarchies, the very hierarchies that fascists seek to protect and restore. We have a lot of work to do to dig out the roots of this evil. It is my hope this afternoon, in a very short period of time, to give us some tools to equip us to recognize fascist tactics when they arise around us and also within our churches and within ourselves as well. I want to offer a hermeneutic which will help us in the work ahead. So let's start by defining the term fascism. The standard definition of fascism is a mass political movement that emphasizes extreme nationalism, militarism, and the supremacy of both the nation and the single powerful leader over the individual citizen. I'm going to complexify that a bit by using the work of Jason Stanley, who is the author of How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Stanley is a professor and scholar of philosophy and propaganda at Yale. He describes fascism as an ideology, but also, and perhaps more importantly, as a political method. Not all who use fascist tactics are ideologically fascist. We recognize fascists less by their beliefs than by their methods. I'm going to share Stanley's overview of the 10 tactics of political fascism. And in full transparency, what I'm sharing with you now is taken directly from Stanley's work, at times word for word from a video. So don't anybody come and tell me I just committed plagiarism, because I warned you. This is from a video lecture that he gave titled The 10 Tactics of Fascism, which is available on YouTube, and I highly recommend watching it more than once. So here are the 10 tactics of fascism. Stanley opens by explaining that these 10 tactics are bundled, that they cannot be isolated from each other. The first tactic is a mythic past. Fascists always present the idea that there was once a glorious past. In politics, this is represented in the idea that we were once a great nation. Notice the past tense. And when we were great, the dominant racial group ruled over others. I think this narrative is going to seem really familiar to you. But now that's been taken away, not lost by the dominant group's actions, but taken away by some group designated as other. Jason Stanley says, fascists are always telling a story about a glorious past that's been lost, and they tap into this nostalgia. So when you fight back against fascism, you've got one hand tied behind your back, because the truth is messy and complex, And the mythical story is always clear and compelling and entertaining. It's hard to undercut that with facts. The second tactic is propaganda. All social movements and all politics use propaganda to persuade. Fascist propaganda, however, makes a distinction between friends and enemies. It casts the other as a threat and presents the idea that these others are fundamentally opposed to the nation. Tactic number three is anti-intellectualism. Authoritarianism presents a cult of the leader. In a fascist system, the leader and only the leader sets the rules about what is true or false. So we will see the takeover of the country's media, schools, and cultural institutions to enforce what the leader says is true. Institutions that teach multiple perspectives on history always threaten the leader. Expertise is also always a threat to the leader. Science is a threat to the leader. And if intellectuals are telling the truth, they are a threat. So, anti-racism, critical race theory, definitely a threat. This brings us directly to tactic number four, the creation of a form of unreality. The scholar Timothy Snyder talks about this a lot, the destruction of notions of reality, that there is an actual reality. Authoritarians determine what we know to be true, undermine what we know to be true, and convince the population that A, everyone is lying, and B, the lies don't matter. In political terms, though, the center of democracy is truth. You cannot function as a democratic citizen if you are being lied to. Jason Stanley says, if you're going to rip the heart out of democracy, you get people used to lies. The fifth tactic of fascism is hierarchy. Hierarchy is absolutely central to fascism. It is the big lie at the center of things. White supremacy, male supremacy, abled supremacy, all of these lies assign people superiority and the privileges and benefits that go with that superiority. And hierarchy goes right into victimhood. Once you have convinced people that they are justifiably higher in the hierarchy, then you can convince them that they are victims of equality. Fascists tell people that equality is victimizing them by making them lose their rightful place or power. Stanley says the goal is to make people feel like victims, to make them feel like they've lost something and that the thing they've lost has been taken from them by a specific enemy, usually some minority outgroup or some opposing nation. According to Ageris Dixon, writing in Truth Out, fascists believe that democracy has failed them and allowed the majority to be tyrannized by communities that have no right to power, that have no right to power. Therefore, fascists seek to eliminate both democratic processes and marginalized communities, to return to an often fictitious and glorified past where their power reigned unchecked. The seventh tactic of fascism is law and order. Under fascism, the definition of law-abiding, though, means loyalty to the dominant group. Members of the dominant group, by their very nature, are considered law-abiding, by very nature. And marginalized groups are seen by their very nature as being not law-abiding. Law and order has nothing to do with justice or equality or protecting people. Law and order structures who is legitimate and who is not. And law and order, my friends, will ultimately be enforced by violence. As fascism scholar Ruth Ben-Ghiat reminds us, the essence of fascism is violence. Now, tactic number 8 is sexual anxiety. In every case, across different cultural and historical settings, the fascist leader will always say, your women and children are under threat. You need a strong man to protect your family. I can't do that without that voice. To protect your families. Fascists make conservatives overwhelmingly terrified of transgendered people and gay, lesbian, and bisexual people and their families. Overwhelmingly terrified. According to fascists, these targeted groups are not simply trying to peacefully live their own lives. They're trying to destroy the majority's life, and they are coming for the majority's children. Stanley calls the 9th tactic of fascism Sodom and Gomorrah. Fascist movements typically rest on an urban-rural divide, and fascists use a toxic trope of the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah. In this trope, pure, hardworking, real members of the nation live in rural areas where they work hard with their hands. But when politicians talk about inner city voters or urban voters, we all know what they mean. Black and queer folks, immigrants, Jews, and other people that fascists seek to control or eliminate. And they pit those two against each other. The 10th tactic is what Stanley, a child of Holocaust survivors, calls Arbeit macht frei, work shall make you free. His words were hung over the gates at Auschwitz. Fascists create an idea that minorities, immigrants, and others are lazy, that these groups need to be taught a work ethic. The mechanism they use is forced labor, whether it's prison labor or work requirements for benefits. The targeted groups must provide free labor as a supposed moral education. According to fascists, then, labor unions are supposedly run by communists who are trying to make things easier for lazy people. College students who protest conservative speakers are described as lazy, spoiled kids who need to get real jobs. The thing is, the end game in this calculation is evil. Valuing people by how hard they work means that the elderly, disabled, and even children can become disposable. The Nazis murdered these groups first because they believed that those who could not work had no value. Is it any wonder that we are now seeing the repeal of child labor laws in this time of rising fascism? Okay, that's Stanley's 10 tactics of fascism. Anybody need a cleansing breath? Now, it's not that each one of these makes a politician or a political movement fascist, but when these elements are present in number, and especially when people are told that they are under an existential threat from the created other, then that's fascism. And it is plain that in the United States, we are in the midst of an orchestrated takeover by fascist political groups. The legislative attacks of the last few months and the civil violence where domestic extremists act to create fear in targeted groups are all on the rise. Remember, fascism is inherently violent, and it begins with these seemingly random actors. But those domestic terrorists are part of the overall plan. Fascist politicians use stochastic terrorism, in which leaders use hate speech to incite seemingly random violence, because a terrified population is more easily controlled, and a terrified population will look for scapegoats. It is vital to understand that we are past the point of voting the fascists out. We have entered an era of violent civil conflict. Voter organizing is no longer a fully sufficient strategy, and we can't keep careening from one election cycle to another. We must work in coalitions to shape a multi-year plan for keeping these fascist politics in check. The ideas of fascism have been activated in a time of great anxiety, about global immigration patterns, technological changes, demographic trends, and about climate disasters and wars for resources. And amidst all of this anxiety, people look for simple answers. And fascist politicians supply those answers all too readily, usually by scapegoating. Voting is important, but our immediate moral obligation is to help people out of the path of direct harm. And I will come back to that. I want us to look a little bit more closely for just a moment, though, at this idea of the glorious past and introduce the work of Roger Griffin, who's a professor of modern history at Oxford Brookes University. Griffin defines fascism as a political ideology whose mythic core, now here come the big words, mythic core is a palingenetic form of populist ultranationalism. That's a mouthful. Palingenetic form of populist ultranationalism. Palingenesis is the concept of rebirth or recreation from the Greek palin, meaning again, and genesis, meaning birth. The defining characteristic of palingenetic fascism is what Griffin describes as the prevalence of the rebirth myth being projected onto the nation of an obsession with degeneration and regeneration as socio-historical realities. In this mythology, the nation has become degenerate because it has fallen away from certain hierarchies, particularly racial or gender hierarchies, and the only way to restore the nation to greatness is to undergo a regeneration, a rebirth, a reclamation of those hierarchies. And the goal, my friends, is always the same: the maintenance of power in the hands of a dictator or a group of people through the use of control and enforced conformity. Now, some of you may have been wondering when I would get to the My Little Pony part of this lecture. We're here. My Little Pony is a kid's show, but the version of this show that aired from 2010 to 2019 is a morally complex and frequently subversive kid's show. The story takes place in a fantasy world populated by adorable, brightly colored ponies, unicorns, and Pegasi, who have names like Twilight Sparkle and Rainbow Dash and such. They live in a deeply feminist, matriarchal society in which the highest value is friendship. And this friendship is a pretty radical kind, and it includes the value of celebrating each pony for their unique self-expression. Each pony has something that's special just to them. These are skills like being a good baker, traits like being very, very kind, or it might be someone's incredible sense of style. And these unique qualities are represented visually on each pony by something called a cutie mark, which is a symbol on the pony's upper flank. The pony baker has a cupcake. The stylish pony has three diamonds. I don't know if you can see those, etc. The plot lines center around a central group of seven ponies and their various adventures. And often these adventures are the ordinary problems of friendship. Things like what happens when you feel envious, or what to do when one of your friends is sad. But there are also episodes with more serious topics. One of my favorites is a two-part episode about, I kid you not, totalitarianism. The band of ponies visits a distant town of ponies where something seems very, very off. Everyone smiles all the time, and the leader is just a little too cheerful. There appears to be no conflict in this town. Most strange is that none of these ponies has a unique cutie mark. Instead, each pony's mark has been replaced by a dull gray equals sign. The intrepid band of friends investigates things and discovers that the leader has tricked the town citizens into giving up their cutie marks. And this then severs them from their unique qualities. The leader has weakened the citizens so that she can control them, which she does by brainwashing the ponies into believing that uniqueness is a dangerous quality that brings conflict and trouble to the community. But of course, the leader of all the ponies has only pretended to give up her cutie mark and her unique qualities. She's covered up her mark with makeup, a fact that our group of intrepid friends discovers. But before the friends can expose her hypocrisy, they are captured, forced to give up their own cutie marks, and imprisoned in a house where they undergo hours of re-education blasting from a loudspeaker. Yes, this is a kid's show. We're going to watch a clip now that begins at that point in the story.
In sameness, there is peace. Exceptionalism is a lie. Free yourself from your cutie mark. Choose a quality as your special talent. Difference is frustration. To excel is to fail. Be your best by never being your best. Conformity will set you free. Conformity will set you free. Conformity will set you free.
Conformity will set you free. Conformity and control are the opposite of freedom. Fascists enforce conformity and control because for fascists to remain in power, they must limit all true expressions of human freedom. Freedom overthrows hierarchies, and without hierarchies, there's no way to retain the power that fascists seek. My friends, there is a specific reason why we are seeing a focused attack on trans rights at this moment. It's because under fascism, difference cannot be allowed to flourish, because difference is a form of freedom, and freedom of human expression must be suppressed. Fascists attempt to keep everyone within the narrow roles prescribed to us and will punish or eliminate anyone who deviates. It is crucial to understand this. Attacks on trans folks are an intentional opening salvo and the first target of this round of fascist organizing. In addition to hating any kind of free self-expression, fascists also always, always try out their tactics on the most vulnerable group. They believe, often rightly, that other people will not act to protect the most vulnerable, especially when they identify a difference that is misunderstood or even generally reviled. Right now, fascists are gauging the public's response. But they will not stop with our trans siblings. And let me be clear, the impact falls most heavily on our trans siblings who are also Black, Indigenous, people of color, poor, and or disabled. Fascists will see what the public allows and will move to control increasingly broader categories. Queer people, immigrants, people of color, Indigenous folks, women in great broad swaths. They intend to make all of us conform. Remember that that law and order means conforming to those hierarchies. It may feel right now like everything is chaotic and that we are struggling on many different fronts, but in actuality, it is all connected. And that sense of chaos, that's also a tactic. Fascists want us overwhelmed and exhausted. Everything fascists do has a point. Each front is another tactic to take and keep power. The attack on the Capitol, threats against governors, defunding of institutions like schools, hospitals, even the potholes in our roads. You know what else? You know what else is a tactic? The lack of COVID response was a tactic. It wasn't ineffectiveness on the part of the Trump administration. It was a deliberate tactic to create chaos and then capitalize upon people's fear and frustration. And oh good, maybe some people would die too. I'm not kidding. It was a tactic. Remember the phrase that went around during the previous administration, the cruelty is the point? That phrase is not quite accurate. Cruelty is not the point, it is a tactic. It is designed to overwhelm us and make us afraid. Perhaps most sickening is this: gun violence is a tactic. Violence and particularly mass shootings serve a purpose: to terrorize the population and make us more fearful and thus more eager for an authoritarian leader who can protect us. And this is the real reason that extremist Republicans do not want to do anything about gun violence. These shootings, yes, including school shootings, are a cynical, horrible, evil tactic. It helps me to think of fascism as a hydra. You all remember the hydra in Greek mythology. Hercules was supposed to kill the hydra, this multi-headed snake creature, and the hydra seemed impossible to kill because every time you cut off one head, it was replaced by two more. Ultimately, Hercules killed the beast by getting help from his nephew to cut off the hydra's main head. This is another opportunity, by the way, to remind ourselves that the myth of the lone hero is actually a useless myth. Okay. A hydra is a multifarious evil that cannot be overcome by a single effort. We have to fight on all fronts, not all of us on all fronts, but on all fronts, while remembering that these heads all grow out of one body. Our coalitions must oppose the fascist desire to control anyone and everyone in order to take and retain power. Now remember, those who use fascist political tactics do not themselves have to have a fascist ideology. And this is very important, and it's very different from how the word fascist has been used in popular culture. However, sometimes fascist ideology is itself a political tactic. When it is used by those in power, it enthralls increasing numbers of people into true believers. People who might not have been enthralled become moved to protect what they think is their rightful place in the hierarchy. Fascist thinking is also contagious. Like COVID, it's not a bacterial infection that can be dispensed with simple antibiotics. My experience with long COVID makes a great metaphor here. Fascism is a disease that remains in the body long after the acute stage passes. It's still there. It's still changing your cells, still causing seemingly unrelated illness and disease. Jason Stanley warns that fascism is a permanent temptation of humankind and that we must be continually vigilant against its resurgence. Our historic faith, my friends, is not immune to these fascist trends here and elsewhere. Some of us have raised concerns about the close ties between our siblings of faith in Eastern Europe with the authoritarian government of Viktor Orban of Hungary. And I believe we are right to be concerned about this situation. And I also know that we have our own rising reactionary strain within North American Unitarian Universalism. And in the interest of both time and an appropriate dose of humility, I'm going to stick to this side of the ocean. We must acknowledge the close ties between our faith's history and our country's political history. We often tell the story of our faith as one of victimization, don't we? We were the heretics that the other Christians tried to throw out. And while that might be true in Europe, it is really not true here. The dominant religion, the religion of those in power for most of this nation's history, has been mainline Protestantism. And though some identify Unitarian Universalists as post-Protestant, there can be no denying that American Unitarian Universalism arose out of mainline Protestantism and that we are still very much a part of the dominant cultural landscape. And one of the primary functions of the institutions of mainline Protestantism was to teach and maintain patriarchal white hegemony. Mainline churches taught and enforced the norms of the ruling class and race, what we sometimes call WASP culture, suppression of conflict, fixation on sexuality, emphasis on control, including controlling bodies and emotions, and children and women, and children and women's bodies, particularly in worship, don't get me started. Norms involving hierarchical structures of power, discomfort with vulnerability, and anything that seems weak, and of course, that high emphasis on conformity. How close is this to fascism? How many fascist tactics have we said are just how we do things? We must keep asking ourselves, how are we protecting and preserving racial and class hegemony as a faith? How are we perpetuating hierarchies based on gender, race, physical or cognitive abilities, or other categories? These are questions that we must explore collectively. We can't dismantle what we don't notice. We have this history, too. As religious professionals, I just want to say a word here, particularly among those of us who are ordained, of creating additional hierarchies among ourselves, do we not? The following are status points and therefore often power points in our realm. Are you an ordained minister? Are you in a parish? Are you the senior minister or a second minister? How large is your congregation? And digging deeper, how much social capital and privilege do you hold in our movement simply by virtue of race, gender, class, or other hierarchies? Do you meet our society's standards for attractiveness? Do you need accommodations based upon a disability? Does your identity contribute to your congregation or workplace being supportive of your ministry? Is your family a structure that your people truly embrace, or does your family structure unsettle gender norms and hierarchies long upheld by the dominant culture? Do you have to spend time explaining or defending your essential identity to members of congregations or to your supervisor? How does this impact the effectiveness of your ministry? Lately, I've heard it said that those of us who are white, cisgender, and particularly male are now at some kind of disadvantage in our movement, and particularly in our hiring and search systems. So let me leverage all the locational privilege that I have to say, if we look at who gets settled and whose ministries receive support or are undermined and who receives higher pay, it is simply not true that white, cis men are at a disadvantage. You guys, when you clap, it takes time. Remember what I said earlier, that when people have been taught that they have a rightful place at the top of the hierarchy, equality feels like a threat? Okay. Resistance to examining white supremacy culture is attached to our locations of privilege, and those of us who bear the most privilege, white privilege, gender privilege, neurological privilege, etc., have been the most resistance. Let's tell the truth. My friends, there's a reason that the work against white supremacy in our movement came up from among our religious educators who have long been held as second-class citizens among our religious professionals. I want to honor the extraordinary contributions of our Lareda colleagues. I am so glad that you are here with us for this conversation, because we owe you a deep debt for your courage and your tenacity. Okay, let's go a little deeper, shall we? In our faith tradition, who controls the resources? Who makes decisions about what gets funded? What are the race, class, gender makeup of the finance committees, the boards, and the treasurers in our congregations and in our association? Ooh, in our people, who is wealthy, who holds assets, and who has generational wealth and privilege? What influence do these folks have as funders and donors? And I say this as a former fundraiser. If we examine how white people have retained wealth in this country over generations, and if we are deeply honest with ourselves, we must confront the fact that all along we have been playing with dirty money. Okay? We need to ask ourselves what reparations will look like. I'm so glad that that work is moving forward. How can we move further into that restorative work instead of quibbling about whether enough white people are getting good jobs? God. And this narrative is aiding the current rise in reactionary thinking in our faith. Some of our people seem particularly drawn to the tactics that I've been discussing. It's important that we keep alert for
for the places the privileged will use these tactics to preserve hierarchy. So I ask you to think now, where in our movement have we seen people do the following? Describing a glorious past, a simple narrative of new victimization by those who have historically held power and privilege, attacks on trans folks and people of color, either by undermining ministries and leadership or by repeating harmful statements in online spaces where there are fewer consequences, and telling and repeating lies until they seem like reality, especially lies about this narrative of victimization. We have important theological shifts rising up, shifts towards justice and shared power. And those who have been historically excluded are rightly insisting on liberation. This threatens the old order, which is determined to retain its power. And there are some among us who are using the language of Unitarianism and liberalism to attempt to suppress those theological shifts that are welling up. It is a terrible truth that those who would cling to power are not easily interested in their own liberation. As a recovering alcoholic, I recognize the ways that power looks a lot like addiction. Indeed, I believe power and privilege are addictions. And my friends, addictions lie. How do we help people understand that what they thought was their own freedom wasn't freedom, it was power? If you've been cutting off parts of yourself to survive, you are not free. If you've been cutting off parts of yourself to gain success, wealth, relationships, prestige, and yes, even if you have been cutting off parts of yourself, trying to create a pocket of safety for yourself, this is not freedom. White women and gay men, I am talking to us. Anything that feels like a loss of access to these means of survival is going to feel like a threat, though. This is an emotional reality. When we talk about white fragility or toxic masculinity or these other ways that folks who are privileged have protected themselves from the truth, we need a trauma-informed lens. If your survival, even as a very young child, depends on conforming to racial or gender norms, then anything that questions those norms may well feel like a threat to one's own safety. We need to remember that liberation is costly, that it is sometimes quite painful to let go of the old worldview. It can be terrifying. Word to those of us who are white or cisgendered or otherwise historically privileged, we need to ask ourselves, what would our liberation look like? Because liberation can't be in any way continuing to cut off parts of ourselves, and our liberation sure as hell doesn't look like continuing to block the liberation of our siblings. To quote Tracy Lewis Gigott, the question is whether white folks will be willing to heal, even if that healing means a loss of status, possible reduction in wealth, and certainly the sacrifice of what they've always believed about themselves and their whiteness. Now, this is very heavy stuff, but I have a strengthening word today for us today. And pretty soon I am going to stop talking and you'll get to hear someone else. In My Little Pony, our brightly colored friends come up with a plan to resist the propaganda, expose the leader's lies, and help the villagers break free of the narrative they've been forced to live. They run the dictator out of town. They work together to get everyone's cutie marks back, thus restoring the fullness of diversity among them. And though it's very simple, and it only took the ponies 12 and a half minutes to do this, they were right. To fight fascists, we have to do several things. We have to insist that truth is real. We have to continue to develop theologies and praxis of liberation. We have to watch for where liberation is rising and follow it. And liberation is not partial. Another one of my beloved pop culture references says,
family means no one gets left behind, right? We must also protect our institutions under authoritarian attacks. Protecting our institutions does not mean preserving old mythologies or old structures of power. Those who would send us back to some glorious age of Unitarianism, whether 1885 or 1985, they are more than misguided. They are functioning from a desire to protect their own privilege and to protect our faith from some made-up threat. Let's just remember that. We must allow our religious tradition to continue to be transformed into a liberatory, liberation-seeking faith. God, wouldn't that be gorgeous? And we must, my friends, transfer leadership. I cannot say this enough. We must follow the leadership of those who have been struggling under historic oppression, those most under attack. No one knows better how to see through the lies, how to resist, how to protect one another. Let me make this utterly clear. It is time to get information behind our queer, trans, black, indigenous, poor, and disabled colleagues. Our collective survival depends upon it. This transfer of leadership is not just some kind of fairness project. It is utterly necessary because no one is better equipped to fight fascists than the targets of fascism. Friends, people in Florida and other states are literally fleeing for their lives and for their children's lives. Our colleagues and lay people are leaving jobs and homes right now because of fascist policies and laws. And again, we're past the point of just telling people to get out and vote. We need to be offering up bedrooms, emptying our bank accounts, and otherwise using all our available resources to save people's lives. Fascism moves swiftly, and it spreads like a deadly virus, and we need a coordinated national response to this crisis among ourselves. So, you don't have to invent responses on your own. Please don't invent responses on your own. There are already groups leading the way if you want to organize with others. The Side with Love team and I are collaborating this summer to offer a two-part webinar following up on this. You can register with that QR code or just stay tuned for more info. And many thanks to Ashley Horan and the team for putting this together. My dear ones, it is very easy to feel frightened and overwhelmed in an upward cycle of fascism. There's a lot of hard work ahead, but there is also joy and friendship and healing on this side. Right here in the struggle, on this side, I urge you to be tenacious in your spiritual practices and your community care. Let us remember all those who came before us and who suffered far, far more than we are suffering in this moment. And let us remember that we are held in the hands of a love that will not let us go and will abide. Beloveds, above all, keep watch for joy. Thank you for listening to me.
I now invite Elizabeth Stevens and C.B. Beale.
Holy shit, Cecilia. Okay, I am Elizabeth Stevens. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a middle-aged white woman with blonde hair.
I am deeply honored to serve as the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Palouse in Moscow, Idaho. In the civil conflict that Cecilia described, my remarks are really best understood as a dispatch from behind enemy lines. Yeah. At this point, the state where I live, the state of Idaho, is essentially under the control of fascist extremists. When I arrived in 2012, Idaho was already a red state. However, in the 10 years I've been there, what I've seen is traditional Republicans, fiscal conservatives who were willing to sort of mind their own business on social issues, were ruthlessly primaried if they failed to toe the extremist line. These primaries were bankrolled by out-of-state interests, including the Koch brothers. I've watched as two brilliant, kind Democratic senators, both members of my congregation, lost their bids to re-election to a guy named Dan Forman, whose top priority is to change the law so that women people who have abortions and their doctors can be tried as felons and tried for first-degree murder and thus be eligible for the death penalty. That's his signature issue. Mind you, Idaho already has some of the most restrictive abortion laws in the country. In the last legislative cycle, gender-affirming care for minors was criminalized, as was helping anyone under the age of 18 access cross state lines to access reproductive care. A bill that would make libraries liable for so-called harmful material passed both of the houses, and the vote to override the gubernatorial veto lost by a single vote. And the extremists aren't just going after schools that offer critical race theory. They're trying to cut funding for anti-bullying programming, which makes a sick kind of sense because fascist tactics look and feel a lot like bullying. And last fall, a memo went out to University of Idaho faculty and staff letting them know that any conversation or research related to abortion or birth control could open them to legal action. Health professionals are leaving the state so that they don't get caught between the rock of the Idaho laws and the hard place of their professional ethics. Parents with children who are non-gender conforming or who are of childbearing age are leaving the state for the sake of their safety. In March, Bonner Healthcare General Health in Sandpoint closed its obstetrics unit because the doctors there didn't feel safe practicing. Now, in my little town, we are home to a Dominionist cult. They believe that they can take over. This is a racist, patriarchal, theocratic cult. They terrorized our city council over the mask mandates. They're currently hanging flags celebrating the overturn of Roe v. Wade in a deliberate campaign to counteract the rainbow flags that are flying in honor of Pride. Every protest that I've attended, there have been counter-protesters, sometimes carrying assault weapons. After I led the Women's March in 2017, a white truck followed me from the church to my house and from my house to church for weeks. In this bleak context, the congregation I serve is flourishing. And it is more than flourishing. My beautiful, wonderful folks continually amaze and humble me with their generosity, their grace, and their commitment. Sophia, I don't know if we could call them obnoxious, but I know that everybody on the Palouse knows who the Unitarian Universalists are. Everybody knows what we stand for. And if I can brag just a little bit, we just completed this gigantic building and expansion project, renovation and expansion. It raised $2.4 million, my little congregation in Moscow, Idaho. And my favorite part is a giant rainbow chalice stained glass window made by one of my congregants that shines out over the entire town 24/7. Now, Now, I actually think that part of our success is really can be attributed to the time that we don't have time or energy for fake fights. Yeah. The real ones we are in have high stakes, and we understand that. We talk a lot about how we can leverage our privilege. We understand that having a community that will support us when our values lead us to acts deemed criminal by the fascists is itself a privilege. And yes, I said when, not if. And those cult members, they are our neighbors, and those of us who can safely do so keep trying to build bridges, because it's hard to hate people you know. People who brought you casseroles after you had surgery, people who shoveled your sidewalk the last time it snowed. Guided by the nourishing words of Black women like Adrienne Marie Brown, Trisha Hersey, Octavia Butler, and Alexis Pauline Gums, we have come to understand and really embody the deep truths that rest is resistance, joy is resistance, and living well is resistance. So don't let me leave out the part of the story where Moscow has an amazing live music scene, an incredible farmer's market. We're surrounded by beautiful hiking trails and scenic rivers. And most days, I say at least once, at least in my evening prayers, how grateful I am for my sweet, sweet life. I'm reminded of an insight that I brought home from a pilgrimage to Transylvania that I went on with Cecilia. That under a fascist regime, one of the most important tactics of resistance is to keep local culture alive and thriving. The sweetness of our lives grounds us and resources us for the acts of courage when they are required. In other words, behind enemy lines, resistance can look like committing felonies, but it can also look like cutting your neighbor's lawn, and it can look like simply living a full and joyful life. It looks like balancing fierce compassion for others with fierce self-compassion. It looks like choosing in any given moment to embrace the power of love rather than yielding to fear. We Unitarian Universalists of the Palouse, along with our friends in Boise, the Twin Falls, Pocatello, Coeur d'Alene, and Idaho Falls, we are keeping the faith behind enemy lines, along with other UUs who are living in radicalized states. We need you with us. Share with us your strength and your courage. Let us know we are not alone. Thank you.
They love you. Hello, good people. Cecilia, those gathered here, thank you for permitting me to address you today to share a word. Three words. Joy. As Cecilia said, the work of justice and liberation requires liberatory joy. Joy requires willingness. So let's practice. Seriously. This joke was invented by Elise the niece, age 5. Why did the chicken cross the road? To get to your house. Wait, there's more. There's more, she says. Knock, knock. Yeah. It's me, the chicken. You're going to remember that joke. To oppose fascism, we must be willing to be surprised by joy and laugh out loud at completely inappropriate moments. Remember that we can break up fear and loose the hold of anxiety and open hearts with joy. Fascists and hierarchies hate uncontrollable joy. I like doing things that fascists hate. Excavation. I invite us to excavate our privilege within and without our faith movement. I've studied and opposed the theocratic and religious right for 35 years. Others here have fought oppression for decades longer. Regardless of time in, those of us who are Black, Indigenous, people of color, disabled, trans, non-binary, and queer, with neurological differences, working class, and those of us who are all of the above in one body, we're flippin' exhausted. But today, I'm not talking about how marginalized and oppressed people respond to or oppose fascism, but about privilege. My experience opposing and dismantling white supremacy as a white person is different than fighting trans antagonism as a trans person or ableism as a person with neurological differences in a country where both of these are targeted by systems that are actively trying to kill me. The first is tiring. The latter two are exhausting, and the difference matters. I can oppose the hierarchy, but because of how whiteness works, I could choose to lean into it. I could cut off the queer and trans part of myself, try to pretend to be typical, and join it, the hierarchy. Privilege creates the possibility of cover. That might make me safer, but it does not make me free. We must all excavate the insidiousness of how privilege works, operates within a hierarchy. I am so grateful for Elizabeth's work and the work of so many others of you who model opposition to fascism by levering your privilege. Your work matters. It's not simple, of course. Imagine, rather than fighting fascism, there's a giant rock buried in the ground, and it needs to move. We can't just smack the rock with a crowbar and declare, "I leverage this rock." We can't just wield a stick of privileged dynamite like Wile E. Coyote, my childhood. We can't. Dismantling and excavating privilege involves making the lever right-sized, angled correctly, and placed at just the right point. People with other perspectives and knowledge closer to the rock may tell us how much or what kind of pressure to apply. We respond to that input and excavate more. The lever itself isn't the thing. It's the excavation. Three. Clarity. Cecilia noted our theological shifts towards justice and shared power. I believe that we gathered here must acknowledge that we have not yet fully scaffolded this continued growth with the nuance and clarity our people need. There are a lot of spaces in Unitarian Universalism in which some people who oppose these theological shifts share simple stories and untruths. They manipulate with misrepresentations like, covenant is a means to authoritarianism. And accountability is a way for a small group of people to control congregations. Some who have prized radical individualism for decades are vulnerable to these misrepresentations in the simple, simple story they come wrapped in. I fear we have all too often avoided clarity and truth-telling about happenings. Facts are true, but only if we say them. We here may have used the language of faith, justice, and liberation cautiously, as if we too find the words themselves might risk pushback or opposition. We collectively have left people vulnerable to misunderstanding, misrepresentation, and outright manipulation. I love our people too much to let this go. These are so often good people who believe untruths and then act accordingly. And more, when we assume that congregational antagonists still act alone, we do our faith a disservice. They are now encouraged, equipped, and lauded behind the scenes for their behavior. It can feel chaotic not to know what congregation will experience what sort of obstructionist or out-of-covenant behavior. Boop, 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 boop. And I fear that chaos is a tactic, but our response is too often like whack-a-mole. It's not tactic for tactic, because whack-a-mole is a game. Professional leadership may choose not to directly oppose these untruths for many reasons, self-preservation among them. But we are not equally targeted or vulnerable. As you are leveraging your privilege to help trans people out of Florida or protect reproductive or immigration rights, I ask that you also attend to our collegial relationships. Assess your vulnerability not by fear, but by privilege, and wade in on behalf of our more vulnerable colleagues. In congregations and among our professional groups, excavate and loosen the hold of hierarchies. Differentiate between responsibility, authority, and hierarchy. Clarify and respect the first two, but hold hierarchy loosely and let it slip away. Identify and set aside the social and cultural norms in which our faith tradition is steeped, and instead explore our particularities of experience and specialization of skill. The moral and material arc of the universe bends towards justice because we together, my colleagues, bend it. Clarity, excavation, and joy. I love doing things fascists hate. So let's practice. Now you tell me, why did the chicken cross the road? Knock, knock. Thank you very much.
We got places to be, things to do, and food to eat. Let's wrap this up, my beloved. On behalf of all members of this conference, I offer deep gratitude to Cecile Kingman and Elizabeth and CB. I want to also thank Lynn Gardner for her 3 years of service on the Berry Street Executive Committee. The Executive Committee chooses, and the UUMA Board has appointed its new member, Elizabeth Stevens. And due to Jose's death, the Executive Committee has chosen and the UUMA Board has appointed for a one-year term the former executive member for a repeat service, Mark Morrison Reed. I had to call in a personal favor. So let me now ease your excitement for our speaker for the Ministerial Conference for Berry Street of 2024. I'm very pleased to name Kim Crawford Harvard. Is she in the house? Oh, no.
I do know that I need to say something, though.
Mm-hmm.
Kate, you have been the scribe for 9 years. And so on behalf of all of the members of the executive committee that you have worked with in those 9 years, on behalf of the 9 essayists who have had a variety of configurations from a panel to co-essayists and single essayists, and on behalf of all of those who have ever attended a Berry Street essay, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for holding both the history
and a vision of what the Berry Street can be. And thank you from the UUMA board on.
Now I've lost my place. Well, I think I hereby, for the last time, close the 2023 Ministerial Conference. Be well, my friends. Be kind to one another. Go forth and be joyous.
Children, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. Yeah, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. I let it shine. Let it shine to show my lover. I wanna tell you that everywhere I go, I'm gonna let it shine.